From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and our first guest this morning is Sister Barbara McCracken from the Benedictine Sisters of Mount St. Scholastica, located in Atchison, Kansas.
That's right. Mount St. Scholastica is a community of Catholic women living by the rule of St. Benedict, seeking God through prayer, ministry, and care for all creation. Sister Barbara, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. I thought we would start with, tell us a little bit about who St. Benedict was.
Okay. Yes, we are a Benedictine monastery founded by St. Benedict and St. Scholastica, his twin sister. They were our Catholic saints, and they lived around the year 480, not 1480, but 480. Right. And so we are the oldest order within the Catholic tradition of religious. And it's been continuous all those years with some waxing and waning, of course, over the centuries.
So, oh, that's really interesting. So Scholastica was Benedict's twin sisters. Oh, okay.
That's... and our monastery is called Mount St. Scholastica for that reason.
Right. Okay, so now what is St. Benedict's and Scholastica's, I guess, philosophy or rules? What is it? What makes St. Benedict stand out?
Well, he did write this rule. It is not very long, and each chapter is very brief. Some are just a paragraph, and at most they'd be like a couple pages. And it's a way to for people who are dedicated to the religious life to try and live the best they can with God's help, you know, in community. So we live in community. We share everything in common, including our finances, of course. And we do live together in this case, we are located, our house is located in eastern Kansas.
And you've been with them since 1961, is that correct?
Yes, I have. I've been here that long, although I spent many years in active ministry in Kansas City, Kansas.
Okay, so like you say, the rule, as I read it in the intro, the rule of St. Benedict is to seek God through prayer, ministry, and care for all creation. So this is an environmental show. So let's talk about what that care for all creation means.
Yes, because we have this long tradition, we try and do what we can here. We're actually kind of on the edge, well, originally on the edge of the small town of Atchison, which is considered a rural town. We're about 50-60 miles north of Kansas City, to give you an idea of where we're located. And we have about, I think, around 60-some acres. And we try and use it in a responsible way. And we try to help use it partly to support ourselves, but in fact also to model for other people how to use the land and the resources that we have, the water, the air.
Yeah, and tell us some of the things that you do on the land there. You've got 53 acres of compost, and you have some beehives. Tell us a little bit more about what that looks like.
Absolutely. We have three arrays of solar panels here. One is on the ground, two are on the tops of buildings. We try and buy hybrid vehicles, not exclusively, but, you know, it's one of our goals is to do more of that, I think. We have a lot of LED lighting. We have, you know, water-reducing toilet fixtures. We have beekeeping, as you mentioned. And we produce quite a bit of honey here, I understand. I do not work in that department, of course, but we sell it in our gift shop. And we give a good amount of it away, I believe. We do organic gardening and composting, and we recently devoted part of our a piece of our land to a community garden. And this summer has been the first summer we've done that, but they have a lot of plans for expanding that, and it's worked partly by some of our sisters, but mostly by people from the local community. We do companion planting to control pests. We don't use pesticide, of course.
Good.
We're trying to do some landscaping using part of our land, trying to get it back into original prairie grass and things like that that were here when the buffaloes were still roaming in large numbers in this area. We do water capture. We have cisterns, and we've had those for, oh my, forever. I think the cisterns are old, but we still use them to get water that comes off the roofs of many of our buildings. And we have some rain barrels also for watering smaller gardens, because it can get pretty hot and dry here, especially towards the end of the summer, usually. We try to remove invasive species as we can. That's an ongoing challenge, of course, with the climate change.
Yeah,
of course, we do the obvious composting and recycling. And we personally try to live as simply as we can. And we donate a lot of, we're always having a little time when we can collect our needed properties that we've acquired one way or another. And we donate a lot of that to the poor.
Yeah.
And we grow a lot of vegetables, of course, and herbs for our own consumption.
Great.
Well, Sister Barbara, also beyond the grounds, you have been known to get involved in some activism. And some of this has to do with how you believe we should be acting in the face of climate change. And I love this quote about you, and you can tell me whether or not this is right, but it says that you've never missed a party, and you are one of the more outspoken sisters. And you like to talk about things that are close to your heart and what means something to you. So again, in the face of climate change, what are some of the things that you have been doing?
Yes, okay. right. Because we are a contemplative community, those of us who are more verbal or at least somewhat more outgoing, maybe we've had more opportunities to get involved in things. So we do write letters to our Congress people on occasion, and the sisters are very good about just about everybody in the community signs them. And we send those to our legislators on various issues around clean energy and climate change, but also basic social justice issues like just wages, and decreasing fossil fuel, that kind of thing, and numerous human rights issues. Clean energy is a big one for us, I would say. Let's see. We try and urge we're on the boards of, like, we have a college here. We used to have it on our campus. And we have a college here in town called Benedictine College. Right. And we have sisters on the board, and they work real hard to try and encourage them to divest from fossil fuels and things like this that have been asked for, actually by Holy Father Francis has asked us to consider doing that to the extent that we can and that we do.
Let me reintroduce you, Sister. We're speaking with Sister Barbara McCracken. She's a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Mount St. Scholastica, located in Atchison, Kansas. We're talking about their programs and initiatives at Mount St. Scholastica. And their followings of St. Benedict and Scholastica. One other thing you kind of adhere to there is the Pope's letter that was written, I guess you'll have to correct me, from a couple years ago, the Laudato Si.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that letter and its role, the role it plays in creation care?
Yes, it's a pretty long letter. We call it an encyclical in our tradition. It actually came out, I believe, in 2015.
Oh.
So we're about to celebrate 10 years of it. And it's the theological, it gives a lot of theological basis for our ecological actions. Because, you know, we aren't really living or working in a vacuum here. We are all connected, of course. And we do see creation as a gift from God. And we have we have this tradition then here of trying to do that before this letter came out. But it's really good, and there's a you can find a couple of short animated not going to think of it right now, little videos actually. There's one called 10 Things to Know About Laudato Si, and it lasts 4 minutes. It's on the internet.
Right.
And it just highlights many of the points that Pope Francis reiterates. he says that some really interesting and I think very spiritual things, that the soil, the water, the mountains, everything is a caress of God. And that we have to view all of creation as God's loving gift, you know, in some sense to humanity, not to exploit it and ruin it, but to actually enjoy it and come to learn to know God in a better way. For many people, you know, nature is their spiritual Bible, as it were.
Yeah.
And we certainly believe that's a really important step. And so being grateful in a spiritual life, the first step is being grateful, you know, in your heart and in your being for everything that we have, but not just our material things, but also actually for all of nature and the beauty of nature, for the sunrise and the sunset and all the food that the land can produce, especially here in an area where we live, where food production and food processing is a very big thing in this part of the world. There's a lot of farmers yet around here.
I'm looking at the general idea that to be a good Christian, whether you're a member of the Benedictine monks or other orders or other forms of Christianity, is to take care of the planet, to care for the planet, because it is,
yes,
in your words, you know, it is a gift of God. It is our role and requirement as good Christians to care for the environment, the water, the air, the land, the insects, the pollinators, everything about this.
Yeah, sure. And I'm curious, as you, I'm sorry, Chris, did you have another point? I'm curious, Sister McCracken, what the reaction that you're getting through some of these companies as you voice your opinions and you go out there and you do these activists organizing.
Oh, right.
What kind of feedback are you getting from these companies?
Well, many corporations are, you know, they're primarily interested in the bottom line financially, and they claim they're very interested in what their shareholders want, and particularly they seem to think, some of them think, the shareholders only want a financial return. But in many cases, many shareholders, you know, they're interested in the corporation using its power, because many of our bigger corporations have such, I think, a tremendous amount of power in our world today. And so this is just, you know, a way to try and get them to be more open to the possibility of using that power for the good of the planet, which also eliminates a lot of their reputational risk, and it can make the company look really, really good if they will, in fact, do things that protect and save the environment. You know, the water, the land, don't use all up all the oil. Let's leave some around, you know, for possible future centuries.
Right.
And to get out of profit as being the only motive that corporations exist for. But, of course, and there are some corporations probably out there, you know, but there, a lot of it is a matter of conversion, which is a big thing in Benedictine life,
right,
that we're always getting converted. And so part of that conversion is coming to a deeper realization that, in fact, creation is a gift of God, and it's to be stewarded and taken care of and fostered and not exploited.
Well, agree.
I don't know. I'm
we
trying
only
to
have
the
a,
big picture here.
I know. Well, no, well said. We only have a couple more minutes.
Okay.
Are there other Benedictine orders around the country? Maybe there's a few out here in Utah or so that you're aware of.
There's a Cistercian house out there I used to have a distant relative who I believe is passed now, but sorry, I can't think of where it is.
But they are, there are other Benedictine orders around the country.
Yes.
And you all have the similar philosophy. And again, as an environmental show, you know, we spend a lot of time talking, you know, in the areas of science and looking, you know, protecting nature via, you know, the role of that science plays in helping us understand why we should care for the planet and the consequences of not caring for the planet. But it's always nice to talk to someone who looks at the caring for the planet from a spiritual side of things. And that's critical.
Yes, and actually we do have a few sisters that are scientists around here still in our community who, you know, we totally embrace science and in fact try to, you know, keep an ear open to that side because we learn a lot of things that help, of course, from science then in how to respond to the issues that we face.
Good.
You know, whether it's on our own property or whether it's just keep up with the national and international issues out there.
Good.
Like oil exploitation of the planet from the oil companies. That's a big one.
Well, we're glad for a voice like yours out there in Kansas and in the communities and speaking to power and talking about the care of our environment and that we all should be stewards of it. So thank you so much, Sister Barbara.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Do you have a website on the internet that we can go to?
Our community does. Yes, it does. It's M-O-U-N-T, Mount, O-S-B, which is the initials for Benedictine, M-O-U-N-T-O-S-B.org.
M-O-U-N-T-O-S-B.org. Great. Thank you so much.
That's our website, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning. We'll turn our attention to the Great Salt Lake. Specifically, we'll discuss potential health hazards from the lake's drying shoreline and the dust that gets kicked up into the atmosphere with Professor Kevin Perry from the University of Utah's Department of Atmospheric Sciences.
Professor Perry is just participated in a new study that is the first to analyze the dust's oxidative potential, which is a measure of its ability to react with oxygen.
Professor Perry, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. Let's talk about the Great Salt Lake. That's your area of research and study. There's been, a new study that suggests that dust coming off the Great Salt Lake has what's called oxidative potential. Can you give us a definition of that?
Sure. So in order to figure out whether or not dust poses a real health hazard, we have to know two things. We have to know essentially how often people are exposed to it and what the concentrations are, but we also need to know whether or not it will be absorbed by your body, because it's possible that some of the metals that are in the dust may be locked up in minerals that won't interact with your body and therefore won't cause a health hazard. So this particular study was looking at how bioavailable the metals in the dust actually are.
How bioavailable they are. So again, so it's, what kind of metals are we talking about? Let's go there.
Right. So this work and other work have identified several, in fact, 13 different metals of potential concern that have high enough concentrations in the soil that if you were exposed to them for significant amounts of time, could actually lead to increases in the cancer rates. The one that's received the most press is arsenic, and this new study was actually not only looking at arsenic, but lithium was another one that is a potential health hazard.
Okay, and so these metals are there naturally. Is that correct?
It's a combination of both natural and industry. So the Great Salt Lake is like your family ancestry. Essentially, everything that you are today is reflected in who you are and the genetics. And for the Great Salt Lake, it has been accumulating the waste products of northern Utah for, you know, the last 150 years. Mm. And everything that has flowed through those rivers and out into the water is still out there unless it blows away. So, for example, arsenic is a naturally occurring element, and it is has high concentrations in the rock in much of Utah. And so when those rivers erode, they take that arsenic down to the lake and deposit it. But there are other elements, you know, that are more closely aligned with human activities, like copper and lead, which also have fairly high concentrations out on the lake bed.
So these metals are in the water column, but most notably in the sediment of the lake. And otherwise, they're, in that case, they're kind of out of the way. Let's say they're not, you know, we're not exposing ourselves to this sediment, so they're not a problem. It's when the sediment gets exposed, or otherwise, you know, the lake dries up and now the sediment is exposed to the atmosphere, that it becomes more of a risk?
That is correct. So 20 years ago, when the lake was higher, most of the dust hotspots that I've identified through my research were actually underwater. Mm-hmm. But the lake has been undergoing significant shrinkage over the last, you know, 25 to 30 years due to a combination of water consumption by agriculture and cities and drought and even climate change. But there's now more than 800 square miles of exposed lake bed out there, and that has exposed all of this sediment to potential wind erosion, which means that it can get lofted from the surface and moved into the surrounding communities when we have high wind events.
And actually, this is kind of timely, because if I'm correct, we're about to have a fairly robust windstorm or a front coming through that could kick up things.
So that is true. So if you remember back a week or two ago, we had 3 or 4 days of really strong winds.
Right.
And there were some people that were predicting, you know, significant dust events. But what they failed to take into account is we had also had monsoon thunderstorms in the previous week. And so I spent a significant amount of time out on the lake bed, and I could tell that that particular wind event, even though it was going to last for 3 or 4 days, wasn't going to produce dust because the surface was just too wet. And when the surface is wet, the sand grains and the dust particles are held together. And so in order to get dust, you have to have dry conditions and strong wind. And the Great Salt Lake is starting to dry out now from the post-monsoon, and there is a potential for dust event this Thursday.
Okay. I know we also get dust, say, off the West Desert, or there are other sources of dust. And of course, now wildfire season, we got that, but that particulate matter in the atmosphere too. Is there a way to tell that dust in the atmosphere is coming from the Great Salt Lake and not other sources? Is there kind of a fingerprint to this dust?
Yeah, the dust has a definite fingerprint. Some work that was done by Greg Carling down at Brigham Young University identified a certain isotope of strontium that is very different at Great Salt Lake versus other, you know, lake beds in Utah. But in order to be able to, you know, say, you know, how much dust is actually coming from the Great Salt Lake, we actually have to be collecting dust samples so that we can analyze it during a dust event. And unfortunately, the Division of Air Quality has shut down almost all of the samplers that collect physical samples of the dust. So at present, there's no way to actually confirm how much dust we get from an upcoming storm would be from Great Salt Lake versus other sources. We would just have to rely upon modeling.
And so is this indefinite, or is this going to be reinstated?
Yeah.
Is this temporary?
So DAQ intended it to be permanent, but there's been a kind of a backlash, specifically from researchers and from the commissioner of the Great Salt Lake, Brian Steed, and the deputy commissioner, Tim Davis. They have asked the Division of Air Quality to ask the legislature for funding to fully outfit the necessary samplers that we could use to actually be able to answer these types of questions, because we think it's definitely in the public interest to know the answer of when we're getting exposed to Great Salt Lake dust versus dust from other sources.
And you have famously been known to go out there on your bike on your own and go and collect these samples.
Yeah, so I've spent more than 200 days doing field work out on Great Salt Lake, all of it by bicycle. I use a fat tire bike. I've done almost 2,700 miles of exploration out on Great Salt Lake.
Wow.
But the thing that we really want to emphasize is that you know, Great Salt Lake is an emerging dust problem. The longer the surface is exposed, the more likely the crust is to start to break apart, and the more likely we are to get dust events. So it's imperative that we do what we can to try and save Great Salt Lake, put water back in the lake, and the co-benefit of that will be much less dust.
And what does it look like for crops or farmers around that area? Are you seeing any of the crops absorbing this, or is that a fear?
So there was a study done by Molly Blakowski, who is a PhD scientist, and Dr. Janice Braney, her supervisor up at Utah State University. And for her PhD thesis, she was actually using vegetable crops and growing them in soil that had been collected from Great Salt Lake to see if the vegetables were able to uptake metals from the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And the results aren't final yet, but it seems to be that those particular plants that she was testing had a high ability to absorb metals from the soil.
Oh, okay. And so vegetable crops, I'm also thinking about alfalfa. I mean, this state grows a lot of alfalfa in and around those the Great Salt Lake. Did she look at that, alfalfa, too?
No, that's not one of the things that was actually being looked at. She was looking at things that are direct consumption for people.
Right. So, like you say, fruits or vegetables grown around there. Is this a local event? First of all, I'm sorry. Let me introduce you. Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Kevin Perry. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, and in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, we're talking about the Great Salt Lake, and in this case specifically, the role that dust can play as a potential public health issue, because dust off the lake can contain a number of different metals, like you mentioned, Kevin, chromium, arsenic, lithium, strontium, maybe it's copper, lead, etc. And those metals, that dust gets into the atmosphere and can impact us on a respiratory level. But like you say, there's some evidence that suggests that these dust and the metals could be taken up by vegetative crops that we consume too. So it's a real serious issue, like you say, Kevin, and the lake continues to decrease in its size. I know it varies and fluctuates over the course of the year, but what is the condition of the lake levels today?
So we had two extremely good snowpacks over the last 2 years.
Right.
And that was not unexpected, because we have a precipitation cycle here in Utah that every 12 or 13 years, we get a really nice snowpack, and sometimes it lasts 1 year, sometimes it lasts two. Back in the 1980s, it was like four, which is really, really unusual. And we're also still in the middle of a mega drought, which can go on for another 10 years or more,
right,
based upon the past history of mega droughts in this region. So I fully expect that we're going to be going back into a time period of reduced snowpack, which puts more pressure on the lake. The lake itself from these 2 years is up 4 feet from the absolute minimum that it had in November of 2022. And 4 feet is great, but that's still lower than it was 5 years ago. And so we're still not back to even where we were when I finished my soil sampling back in 2018.
Okay. Now, getting back to the dust, when it gets in the atmosphere, is this more of a localized issue? How far can this dust travel, or are you kind of monitoring that?
So when you put particles in the atmosphere, the bigger particles will just fall out from gravity. So mm-hmm. you go to the beach and you take a handful of sand, you throw it up in the air, and all the sand grains come back down. If you go to a farmer's field and you pick up a handful of dirt, you throw it up in the air, the big clods will come back down, but there'll be a wafting away of dust. Mm. And it's those small particles that remain suspended in the atmosphere. And the only effective way to remove those small particles from the atmosphere is through rain. And generally speaking, it takes about 2 weeks for any air parcel on the planet to undergo a rain event. So the dust that comes off the Great Salt Lake, the big particles will deposit close, you know, in the cities and the surrounding things, and the small particles will stay in the atmosphere for on average about 2 weeks, which means that they'll get transported all the way across our country and out over the oceans. And we see this all the time with you know, much bigger dust sources like the Saharan Desert. It generates dust plumes that go out over the Atlantic and into the eastern United States. The big dust sources in Asia, the Taklamakan Desert and the Gobi Desert, they generate dust storms that loft that dust and bring it across the Pacific and into the United States. And so dust is actually a global problem, although, you know, the significant health impacts of Great Salt Lake dust is certainly going to be a local phenomenon.
And what is happening with the organisms that are living there as this is drying up? Are they part of this particulate that is, as they die off, or what is happening with all of them?
So there are different types of particles that can be generated, and they can, you know, for example, we can just have, you know, dust, which is mineral stuff. But you can also have bacteria and fungus that are growing out on the lake bed that can get lofted. And research on those types of things is really just in its infancy. There was a study done at Salton Sea that identified a certain polysaccharide, which was in the cell wall of a certain bacteria that was responsible for most of the asthma downwind of Salton Sea. And there's a group of researchers here at the University of Utah that are now looking at dust from Great Salt Lake to see if it has this same, you know, polysaccharide in it. And I think that they're getting ready to publish, or just published, their first results on that.
Yeah. So another question regarding dust and dust size. I know Department of Air Quality monitors dust or air quality particulate matter in terms of 2.5 microns and 10 microns, PM10, PM2.5. Does dust from the Great Salt Lake have a certain size, or does it kind of show up in both as a 2.5 or a PM10?
Yeah, the dust has a very wide size range.
Yeah.
Some of it will show up in the 2.5 range. Most of it will show up in PM10, and out closer to the lake, you'll get things that are even bigger than 10 microns that don't show up in the samplers. And we call that total suspended particulate. The ratio of the smaller particles, the PM2.5 to PM10 for Great Salt Lake dust, is about, you know, 15%. So, you know, when you have a dust event, you know, about 15% of that dust will go deep in your lungs, and 85% of it will end up in your nasal and your throat and the upper respiratory system when you breathe it in.
So it's that 15% then that is really the type that you're really paying attention to, because that's dust that could also be carrying metals.
That's one of the takes on this, but the issue is that when the dust ends up in your nose and in your throat, a lot of that actually ends up going through your digestive system, where you have this highly acidic fluid in your stomach that can actually leach those metals out. And so you actually have two exposure pathways. You have the inhalation, which goes deep in your lungs, but you also have ingestion. Even though you don't think that you're actually, you know, eating dust, you actually are, because of the way that your body naturally tries to cleanse itself of the things that you breathe in that get stuck in your nose and your throat.
So the metals could, so the metals could actually work their way into a system via your lungs or via your stomach lining, your intestines.
Yes, that is correct.
Oh, boy. Okay. We're learning a lot here on the show. That is really fast. Is there one track path that's worse than the other? Or is that still to be determined?
That's still to be determined. And, you know, there are not even standards. There are not even air quality standards for these metals, because the science hasn't actually figured out, you know, what's the concentration of arsenic in the air that would generate a certain response in humans. We have that type of research for PM10 and PM2.5, which is why they're regulated. But without the science, we can't establish, you know, defensible regulations. And so that's why we label these things contaminants of potential concern. And then we're trying to do more research to find out if they pose an actual hazard or not.
So, Kevin, what is the path forward then? What, as you're accumulating all this knowledge and you're going through these studies, what do you see as the next step, or what is that path?
So the next step, you know, we have a very good idea of what is in the dust, the soil out on Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. What we are really lacking right now is a way to systematically measure how frequent these dust events are and what the concentrations of that dust are in the surrounding communities. We can't even answer a basic question of, you know, which communities around Great Salt Lake are most impacted by the dust. And why is this? Because we don't have a robust network of PM10 samplers that can actually, measure this sort of stuff and collect the physical samples so that we can actually tie the dust to Great Salt Lake. Give an example, Salton Sea in California, mm-hmm. is another lake that's drying up. It has significant dust storms that are coming off of that. The state of California decided that they were going to try and understand this. They, in a matter of 2 years, they put out 14 sampling sites, seven of them right around the periphery of the lake and seven of them in the surrounding communities. And they fully funded this for both the samplers that collect the physical samples and samplers that collect data every hour, so that you can kind of see, you know, the individual events. And I would really like to see Utah do something like that, because I'm tired of, you know, talking about dust without being able to answer the question that everybody wants to know is, does this pose a real hazard to people living in northern Utah?
Right.
And so what can citizens do to help in this matter, yeah. or what are we called to do?
Yeah, sorry, 30 seconds.
Yep. So the legislators control the money for the Division of Air Quality. And you can reach out to your legislators and encourage them to fully fund a network of air quality samplers that can, answer the questions of how often we are being exposed to dust from Great Salt Lake.
All right, Kevin Perry, we'll have to leave it there. Kevin Perry, professor of atmospheric sciences at the Department of Atmospheric Sciences and the University of Utah. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth, and I think we're going to have you back for an update on that.
Absolutely.
Sounds
Thank
good.
You, Kevin.
All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm.